Ah, my cargo. Here is the itemized list. Personal property only. We are not here to trade. As I told you, we are simply tourists. The customs official looked about curiously.
This is rather an elaborate vessel for tourists.
Not by Foundation standards, said Treves, with a display of good humor. And I'm well off and can afford this.
Are you suggesting that I might be vitrified?
The official looked at him briefly, then looked away. Treves hesitated a moment in order to interpret the meaning of the word, then another moment to decide his course of action. He said, No, it is not my intention to bribe you. I have no reason to bribe you, and you don't look like the kind of person who could be bribed, if that were my intention. You can look over the ship if you wish.
No need, said the official, putting away his pocket recorder. You have already been examined for specific contraband infection and have passed. The ship has been assigned radio wavelength, will serve as an approach beam.
He left. The whole procedure had taken 15 minutes. Pellerat said in a low voice,
Could he have made trouble? Did he really expect a bribe?
Treves shrugged. Tipping the customs man is as old as the galaxy, and I would have done it readily if he had made a second try for it. As it is, well, I presume he prefers not to take a chance with a Foundation ship, and a fancy one at that. The old mayor, bless her cross-grained hide, said the name of the Foundation would protect us wherever we went, and she wasn't wrong. It could have taken a great deal longer.
Why? He seemed to find out what he wanted to know.
Yes, but he was courteous enough to check us by remote radio scanning. If he had wished, he could have gone over the ship with a hand machine and taken hours. He could have put us both in a field hospital and kept us days.
What? Oh, my dear fellow!
Don't get excited. He didn't do it. I thought he might, but he didn't. Which means we're free to land. I'd like to go down gravitically, which could take us 15 minutes. But I don't know where the permitted landing sites might be, and I don't want to cause trouble. That means we'll have to follow the radio beam, which will take hours, as we spiral down through the atmosphere. Pellerat looked cheerful.
But that's excellent, Golan. Will we be going slowly enough to watch the terrain?
He held up his portable view screen with the map spread out on it at low magnification. After a fashion, we'd have to get beneath the cloud deck, and we'll be moving at a few kilometers per second. It won't be ballooning through the atmosphere, but you'll spot the planetography.
Excellent, excellent.
Treves said thoughtfully, I'm wondering, though, if we'll be on Seychelles Planet long enough to make it worth our while to adjust the ship's clock to local time.
It depends on what we plan to do, I suppose. What do you think we'll be doing, Golan?
Our job is to find Gaia, and I don't know how long that will take. Pellerat said,
We can adjust our wrist strips and leave the ship's clock as is.
Good enough, said Treves. He looked down at the planet spreading broadly beneath them. No use waiting any longer. I'll adjust the computer to our assigned radio beam, and it can use the gravitics to mimic conventional flight. So, let's go down, Genoff, and see what we can find. He stared at the planet thoughtfully as the ship began to move on its smoothly adjusted gravitational potential curve. Treves had never been in the Seychelles Union, but he knew that over the last century it had been steadfastly unfriendly to the Foundation. He was surprised and a little dismayed they had gotten through customs so quickly. It didn't seem reasonable. 40. The customs official's name was Jogoroth Sabhadarta, and he had been serving on the station on and off for half his life. He didn't mind the life, for it gave him a chance 1 month out of three to view his books, to listen to his music, and to be away from his wife and growing son. Of course, during the last 2 years, the current head of customs had been a dreamer, which was irritating. There is no one so insufferable as a person who gives no other excuse for a peculiar action than saying he had been directed to it in a dream. Personally, Sabhadarta had decided he believed none of it, though he was careful not to say so aloud, since most people on Seychelles rather disapproved of anti-psychic doubts. To become known as a materialist might put his forthcoming pension at risk. He stroked the two tufts of hair at his chin, one with his right hand and the other with his left, cleared his throat rather loudly, and then, with inappropriate casualness, said,
Was that the ship head?
The head, who bore the equally Seychellian name of Namarath Gadsivata, was concerned with a matter involving some computer-borne data and did not look up.
What ship?
He said.
The Far Star. The Foundation ship. The one I just sent past. The one that was holographed from every angle. Was that the one you dreamed of?
Gadsivata looked up now. He was a small man, with eyes that were almost black and were surrounded by fine wrinkles that had not been produced by any penchant for smiling. He said,
Why do you ask?
Sabhadarta straightened up and allowed his dark and luxuriant eyebrows to approach each other.
They said they were tourists, but I've never seen a ship like that before, and my own opinion is they're Foundation agents.
Gadsivata sat back in his chair.
See here, my man. Try as I might, I cannot recall asking for your opinion.
But, Head, I consider it my patriotic duty to point out that...
Gotisavata crossed his arms over his chest and stared hard at the underling, who, though much the more impressive in physical stature and bearing, allowed himself to droop and take on a somehow bedraggled appearance under the gaze of his superior. Gotisavata said,
My man, if you know what is good for you, you will do your job without comment, or I'll see to it that there will be no pension when you retire, which will be soon if I hear any more on a subject that does not concern you.
In a low voice, Subhadarta said,
Leffler.
Then, with a suspicious degree of subservience in his voice, he added,
Is it within the range of my duty, sir, to report that a second ship is in range of our screens?
Consider it reported,
Gaudisavata said irritably, returning to his work.
With, Subhadarta, even more humbly, characteristics very similar to the one I just sent through.
Gaudisavata placed his hands on the desk and lifted himself to his feet.
A second one?
Subhadarta smiled inwardly. That sanguinary person, born of an irregular union, he was referring to the head, had clearly not dreamed of two ships. He said,
Apparently, sir, I will now return to my post and await orders, and I hope, sir...
Yes?
Subhadarta could not resist, pension risk notwithstanding.
And I hope, sir, we didn't send the wrong one through.
41. The Far Star moved rapidly across the face of Seychelles Planet, and Tellarat watched with fascination. The cloud layer was thinner and more scattered than upon Terminus, and precisely as the map showed, the land surfaces were more compact and extensive, including broader desert areas to judge by the rusty color of much of the continental expanse. There were no signs of anything living. It seemed a world of sterile desert, gray plain of endless wrinkles that might have represented mountainous areas, and, of course, of ocean.
It looks lifeless, muttered Tellarat.
You don't expect to see any life signs at this height, said Treviz. As we get lower, you'll see the land turn green in patches. Before that, in fact, you'll see the twinkling landscape on the night side. Human beings have a penchant for lighting their worlds when darkness falls. I've never heard of a world that's an exception to that rule. In other words, the first sign of life you'll see will not only be human, but technological. Tellarat said thoughtfully,
Human beings are diurnal in nature, after all. It seems to me that among the very first tasks of a developing technology would be the conversion of night to day. In fact, if a world lacked technology and developed one, you ought to be able to follow the progress of technological development by the increase in light upon the darkened surface. How long would it take, do you suppose, to go from uniform darkness to uniform light?
Treviz laughed. You have odd thoughts, but I suppose that comes from being a mythologist. I don't think a world would ever achieve a uniform glow. Night light would follow the pattern of population density, so that the continents would spark in knots and strings. Even Trantor, at its height, when it was one huge structure, let light escape that structure only at scattered points. The land turned green, as Treviz had predicted, and on the last circling of the globe, he pointed out markings that he said were cities. It's not a very urban world. I've never been in the Seychelles Union before, but according to the information the computer gives me, they tend to cling to the past. Technology, in the eyes of all the galaxy, has been associated with the Foundation, and wherever the Foundation is unpopular, there is a tendency to cling to the past. Except, of course, as far as weapons of war are concerned. I assure you, Seychelles is quite modern in that respect.
Dear me, Golan, this is not going to be unpleasant, is it? We are Foundationers, after all, and being in enemy territory...
It's not enemy territory, Janov. They'll be perfectly polite, never fear. The Foundation just isn't popular, that's all. Seychelles is not part of the Foundation Federation. Therefore, because they're proud of their independence, and because they don't like to remember that they are much weaker than the Foundation, and remain independent only because we're willing to let them remain so, they indulge in the luxury of disliking us.
I fear it will still be unpleasant, then, said Tellarat despondently.
Not at all, said Treviz. Come on, Janov. I'm talking about the official attitude of the Seychellian government. The individual people on the planet are just people, and if we're pleasant and don't act as though we're lords of the galaxy, they'll be pleasant, too. We're not coming to Seychelles in order to establish Foundation mastery. We're just tourists, asking the kind of questions about Seychelles that any tourist would ask. And we can have a little legitimate relaxation, too, if the situation permits. There's nothing wrong with staying here a few days and experiencing what they have to offer. They may have an interesting culture, interesting scenery, interesting food, and, if all else fails, interesting women. We have money to spend.
Tellarat frowned. Oh, my dear chap.
Come on, said Treviz. You're not that old. Wouldn't you be interested?
Well, I don't say there wasn't a time when I played that role properly, but surely this isn't the time for it. We have a mission. We want to reach Gaia. I have nothing against a good time. I really don't. But if we start involving ourselves, it might be difficult to pull free.
He shook his head and said mildly, I think you feared that I might have too good a time at the Galactic Library on Trantor and would be unable to pull free. Surely, what the library is to me, an attractive, dark-eyed damsel, or five or six, might be to you.
Trevise said, I'm not a Raquel, Janoff, but I have no intention of being ascetic either.
Very well, I promise you, we'll get on with this business of Gaia. But if something pleasant comes my way, there's no reason in the galaxy I ought not to respond normally.
If you'll just put Gaia first, I will.
Just remember, though, don't tell anyone we're from the Foundation. They'll know we are, because we've got Foundation credits and we speak with strong Terminus accents. But if we say nothing about it, they can pretend we are placeless strangers and be friendly. If we make a point of being Foundationers, they will speak politely enough, but they will tell us nothing, show us nothing, take us nowhere, and leave us strictly alone.
Pallarat sighed. I will never understand people.
There's nothing to it. All you have to do is take a close look at yourself, and you will understand everyone else. We're in no way different ourselves. How would Selden have worked out his plan, and I don't care how subtle his mathematics was, if he didn't understand people? And how could he have done that if people weren't easy to understand? You show me someone who can't understand people, and I'll show you someone who has built up a false image of himself. No offense intended.
None taken. I'm willing to admit I'm inexperienced, and that I've spent a rather self-centered and constricted life. It may be that I've never really taken a good look at myself. So I'll let you be my guide and advisor where people are concerned.
Good. Then take my advice now and just watch the scenery. We'll be landing soon, and I assure you, you'll feel nothing. The computer and I will take care of everything.
Conan, don't be annoyed. If a young woman should...
Forget it. Just let me take care of the landing. Pallarat turned to look at the world at the end of the ship's contracting spiral. It would be the first foreign world upon which he would ever stand. The thought somehow filled him with foreboding, despite the fact that all the millions of inhabited planets in the galaxy had been colonized by people who had not been born upon them. All but one, he thought with a shudder of trepidation, delight.
42.
The spaceport was not large by Foundation standards, but it was well kept. Trevise watched the Far Star moved into a berth and locked in place. They were given an elaborate coded receipt.
Pallarat said in a low voice, Do we just leave it here?
Trevise nodded and placed his hand on the other's shoulder in reassurance.
Don't worry, he said in an equally low voice.
They stepped into the ground car they had rented, and Trevise plugged in the map of the city, whose towers he could see on the horizon. Seychelles City, he said, the capital of the planet. City, planet, star, all named Seychelles.
I'm worried about the ship, insisted Pallarat.
Nothing to worry about, said Trevise. We'll be back tonight, because it will be our sleeping quarters if we have to stay here more than a few hours. You have to understand, too, that there's an interstellar code of spaceport ethics that, as far as I know, has never been broken, even in wartime. Spaceships that come in peace are inviolate. If that were not so, no one would be safe, and trade would be impossible. Any world on which that code was broken would be boycotted by the space pilots of the galaxy. I assure you, no world would risk that. Besides, I've arranged with the computer that anyone who doesn't look and sound like one of us will be killed if he or she tries to board the ship. I've taken the liberty of explaining that to the port commander. I told him very politely that I would love to turn off that particular facility out of deference to the reputation that the Seychelles City spaceports hold for absolute integrity and security throughout the galaxy, I said. But the ship is a new model, and I didn't know how to turn it off.
He didn't believe that, surely.
Of course not. But he had to pretend he did, as otherwise he would have no choice but to be insulted. And since there would be nothing he could do about that, being insulted would only lead to humiliation. And since he didn't want that, the simplest path to follow was to believe what I said.
And that's another example of how people are?
Yes. You'll get used to this.
How do you know this ground car isn't bugged?
I thought it might be. So when they offered me one, I took another one at random. If they're all bugged, well, what have we been saying that's so terrible?
Pallarat looked unhappy. I don't know how to say this. It seems rather impolite to complain, but I don't like the way it smells. There's an odor.
In the ground car?
Well, in the spaceport, to begin with. I suppose that's the way spaceports smell, but the ground car carries the odor with it. Could we open the windows?
Trevise laughed. I suppose I could figure out which portion of the control panel will do that trick, but it won't help. This planet stinks. Is it very bad?
Well, it's not very strong, but it's noticeable and somewhat repulsive. Does the whole world smell this way? I keep forgetting you've never been on another world. Every inhabited world has its own order. It's the general vegetation, mostly, though I suppose the animals and even the human beings contribute. As far as I know, nobody ever likes the smell of any world when he first lands on it. But you'll get used to it, Genoff. In a few hours, I promise you won't notice.
Surely you don't mean that all worlds smell like this?
No. As I said, each has its own. If we really paid attention, or if our noses were a little keener like those of Anacreonian dogs, we could probably tell which world we were on with one sniff. When I first entered the Navy, I could never eat the first day on a new world. Then I learned the old spacer trick of sniffing a handkerchief with the world scent on it during the landing. By the time you get out into the open world, you don't smell it. And after a while, you get hardened to the whole thing. You just learn to disregard it. The worst of it is returning home, in fact.
Why?
Do you think Terminus doesn't smell?
Are you telling me it does?
Of course it does. Once you get acclimated to the smell of another world, such as Seychelles, you'll be surprised at the stench of Terminus. In the old days, whenever the locks opened on Terminus after a sizable tour of duty, all the crew would call out, "Back home to the crap." Pellaret looked revolted. The towers of the city were perceptibly closer, but Pellaret kept his eyes fixed on their immediate surroundings. There were other ground cars moving in both directions, and an occasional air car above, but Pellaret was studying the trees.
He said, "The plant life seems strange. Do you suppose any of it is indigenous?"
"I doubt it," said Trevise absently. He was studying the map and attempting to adjust the programming of the car's computer. "There's not much in the way of indigenous life on any human planet. Settlers always imported their own plants and animals, either at the time of settling or not too long afterward."
"It seems strange, though."
"You don't expect the same varieties from world to world, Janoff. I was once told that the Encyclopedia Galactica people put out an atlas of varieties which ran to 87 fat computer disks and was incomplete even so, and outdated anyway by the time it was finished." The ground car moved on, and the outskirts of the city gaped and engulfed them. Pellaret shivered slightly.
"I don't think much of their city architecture."
"To each his own," said Trevise with the indifference of the seasoned space traveler.
"Where are we going, by the way?"
"Well," said Trevise with a certain exasperation, "I'm trying to get the computer to guide this thing to the tourist center. I hope the computer knows the one-way streets and the traffic regulations, because I don't."
"What do we do there, Golan?"
"To begin with, we're tourists, so that's the place where we'd naturally go, and we want to be as inconspicuous and natural as we can. And secondly, where would you go to get information on Gaia?"
Pellaret said, "To a university, or an anthropological society, or a museum. Certainly not to a tourist center."
"Well, you're wrong. At the tourist center, we will be intellectual types who are eager to have a listing of the universities in the city and the museums and so on. We'll decide where to go first, and there we may find the proper people to consult concerning ancient history, galactography, mythology, anthropology, or anything else you can think of. But the whole thing starts at the tourist center." Pellaret was silent, and the ground car moved on in a tortuous manner as it joined and became part of the traffic pattern. They plunged into a sub-road and drove past signs that might have represented directions and traffic instructions, but were in a style of lettering that made them all but unreadable. Fortunately, the ground car behaved as though it knew the way, and when it stopped and drew itself into a parking spot, there was a sign that said, "Seychelles Outworld Milieu," in the same difficult printing, and under it, "Seychelles Tourist Center," in straightforward, easy-to-read Galactic Standard lettering. They walked into the building, which was not as large as the facade had led them to believe. It was certainly not busy inside. There were a series of waiting booths, one of which was occupied by a man reading the news strips emerging from a small ejector. Another contained two women who seemed to be playing some intricate game with cards and tiles. Behind a counter too large for him, with winking computer controls that seemed far too complex for him, was a bored-looking Seychellian functionary wearing what looked like a multicolored checkerboard. Pellaret stared and whispered,
"This is certainly a world of extroverted garb."
"Yes," said Trevise, "I noticed. Still, fashions change from world to world, and even from region to region within a world sometimes. And they change with time. 50 years ago, everyone on Seychelles might have worn black, for all we know. Take it as it comes, Genoff."
"I suppose I'll have to," said Pellaret, "but I prefer our own fashions. At least, they're not an assault upon the optic nerve."
"Because so many of us are gray on gray? That offends some people. I've heard it referred to as dressing in dirt. Then, too, it's foundation colorlessness that probably keeps these people in their rainbows, just to emphasize their independence. It's all what you're accustomed to, anyway. Come on, Genoff." The two headed toward the counter,
and as they did so, the man in the booth forsook his news items, rose, and came to meet them, smiling as he did so. His clothing was in shades of gray. Trapeze didn't look in his direction first, but when he did, he stopped dead. He took a deep breath. By the galaxy, my friend the traitor.
Chapter 12. Agent. 43. Mun Li Kampor, councilman of Terminus, looked uncertain as he extended his right hand to Trevise. Trevise looked at the hand sternly and did not take it. He said apparently to open air, I am in no position to create a situation in which I may find myself arrested for disturbing the peace on a foreign planet, but I will do so anyway if this individual comes a step closer.
Kampor stopped abruptly, hesitated, and finally said in a low voice after glancing uncertainly at Pellerat, Am I to have a chance to talk, to explain? Will you listen?
Pellerat looked from one to the other with a slight frown on his long face. He said,
What's all this, Golan? Have we come to this far world and at once met someone you know?
Trevise's eyes remained firmly fixed on Kampor, but he twisted his body slightly to make it clear that he was talking to Pellerat.
Trevise said, This human being, we would judge that much from his shape, was once a friend of mine on Terminus. As is my habit with my friends, I trusted him. I told him my views, which were perhaps not the kind that should have received a general airing. He told them to the authorities in great detail, apparently, and did not take the trouble to tell me he had done so. For that reason, I walked neatly into a trap, and now I find myself an exile. And now this human being wishes to be recognized as a friend.
He turned to Kampor full on and brushed his fingers through his hair, succeeding only in disarranging the curls further.
See here, you. I do have a question for you. What are you doing here? Of all the worlds in the galaxy on which you could be, why are you on this one, and why now?
Kampor's hand, which had remained outstretched throughout Trevise's speech, now fell to his side, and the smile left his face. The air of self-confidence, which was ordinarily so much a part of him, was gone, and in its absence he looked younger than his 34 years and a bit woebegone.
I'll explain, he said, but only from the start.
Trevise looked about briefly. Here? You really want to talk about it here, in a public place? You want me to knock you down here after I've listened to enough of your lies?
Kampor lifted both hands now, palms facing each other. It's the safest place, believe me.
And then, checking himself and realizing what the other was about to say, added hurriedly,
Oh, don't believe me. It doesn't matter. I'm telling the truth. I've been on the planet several hours longer than you, and I've checked it out. This is some particular day they have here on Seychelles. It's a day for meditation, for some reason. Almost everyone is at home, or should be. You see how empty this place is. You don't suppose it's like this every day?
Pellerat nodded and said, I was wondering why it was so empty at that.
He leaned toward Trevise's ear and whispered, Why not let him talk, Golan? He looks miserable, poor chap, and he may be trying to apologize. It seems unfair not to give him the chance to do so.
Trevise said, Dr. Pellerat seems anxious to hear you. I'm willing to oblige him, but you'll oblige me if you're brief about it. This may be a good day on which to lose my temper. If everyone is meditating, any disturbance I cause may not produce the guardians of the law. I may not be so lucky tomorrow. Why waste an opportunity?
Kampor said in a strained voice, Look, if you want to take a poke at me, do so. I won't even defend myself. See? Go ahead, hit me, but listen.
Go ahead and talk, then. I'll listen for a while.
In the first place, Golan, address me as Trevise, please. I am not on first-name terms with you. In the first place, Trevise, you did too good a job convincing me of your views.
You hid that well. I could have sworn you were amused by me.
I tried to be amused to hide from myself the fact that you were being extremely disturbing. Look, let us sit down up against the wall. Even if the place is empty, some few may come in, and I don't think we ought to be needlessly conspicuous.
Slowly, the three men walked most of the length of the large room. Kampor was smiling tentatively again, but remained carefully at more than arm's length from Trevise. They sat each on a seat that gave as their weight was placed upon it, and molded itself into the shape of their hips and buttocks. Pellerat looked surprised and made as though to stand up.
Relax, Professor, said Kampor. I've been through this already. They're in advance of us in some ways. It's a world that believes in small comforts.
He turned to Trevise, placing one arm over the back of his chair and speaking easily now.
You disturbed me. You made me feel the Second Foundation did exist, and that was deeply upsetting. Consider the consequences if they did. Wasn't it likely that they might take care of you somehow, remove you as a menace? And if I behaved as though I believed you, I might be removed as well. Do you see my point?
I see a coward.
What good would it do to be storybook brave, said Kampor warmly, his blue eyes widening in indignation?
Can you or I stand up to an organization capable of molding our minds and emotions? The only way we could fight effectively would be to hide our knowledge to begin with.
So you did it and were safe? Yet you didn't hide it from Mayor Brano, did you? Quite a risk there.
Yes, but I thought that was worth it. Just talking between ourselves might do nothing more than get ourselves mentally controlled, or our memories erased altogether. If I told the mayor, on the other hand, she knew my father well, you know. My father and I were immigrants from Smyrna, and the mayor had a grandmother who...
Yes, yes, said Treves impatiently. And several generations farther back, you can trace ancestry to the Syria sector. You've told all that to everyone you know. Get on with it, Campor.
Well, I had her ear. If I could convince the mayor that there was danger using your arguments, the Federation might take some action. We're not as helpless as we were in the days of the mule, and, at the worst, this dangerous knowledge would be spread more widely, and we ourselves would not be in as much specific danger.
Treves said sardonically, endanger the Foundation, but keep ourselves safe. That's good patriotic stuff. That would be at the worst. I was counting on the best. His forehead had become a little damp. He seemed to be straining against Treves's immovable contempt.
And you didn't tell me of this clever plan of yours, did you?
No, I didn't. And I'm sorry about that, Treves. The mayor ordered me not to. She said she wanted to know everything you knew, but that you were the sort of person who would freeze if you knew that your remarks were being passed on.
How right she was. I didn't know. I couldn't guess. I had no way of conceiving that she was planning to arrest you and throw you off the planet.
She was waiting for the right political moment when my status as councilman would not protect me. You didn't foresee that?
How could I? You yourself did not.
Had I known that she knew my views, I would have. Campor said with a sudden trace of insolence.
That's easy enough to say, in hindsight.
And what is it you want of me here, now that you have a bit of hindsight, too?
To make up for all this. To make up for the harm I unwittingly did you.
Goodness, said Treves dryly. How kind of you. But you haven't answered my original question. How did you come to be here? How do you happen to be on the very planet I am on? Campor said, there's no complicated answer necessary for that. I followed you. Through hyperspace, with my ship making jumps in series. Campor shook his head. No mystery. I have the same kind of ship you do, with the same kind of computer. You know, I've always had this trick of being able to guess in which direction, through hyperspace, a ship would go. It's not usually a very good guess, and I'm wrong 2 times out of 3. But with the computer, I'm much better. And you hesitated quite a bit at the start, and gave me a chance to evaluate the direction and speed in which you are going before entering hyperspace. I fed the data, together with my own intuitive extrapolations, into the computer, and it did the rest.
And you actually got to the city ahead of me?
Yes. You didn't use gravitics, and I did. I guessed you would come to the capital city, so I went straight down. While you... Campor made a short spiral motion with his finger, as though it were a ship riding a directional beam. You took a chance on a run-in with Seychelles and officialdom?
Well...
Campor's face broke into a smile that lent it an undeniable charm, and Treves felt himself almost warming to him. Campor said, I'm not a coward at all times and in all things. Treves steeled himself. How did you happen to get a ship like mine?
In precisely the same way you got a ship like yours. The old lady, Mayor Brano, assigned it to me.
Why?
I'm being entirely frank with you. My assignment was to follow you. The mayor wanted to know where you were going and what you would be doing.
And you've been reporting faithfully to her, I suppose. Or have you been faithless to the mayor also?
I reported to her. I had no choice, actually. She placed a hyper relay on board ship, which I wasn't supposed to find, but which I did find.
Well?
Unfortunately, it's hooked up so that I can't remove it without immobilizing the vessel. At least, there's no way I can remove it. Consequently, she knows where I am, and she knows where you are.
Suppose you hadn't been able to follow me. Then she wouldn't have known where I was, had you thought of that.
Of course I did. I thought of just reporting I had lost you. But she wouldn't have believed me, would she? And I wouldn't have been able to get back to Terminus for who knows how long. And I'm not like you, Treves. I'm not a carefree person without attachments. I have a wife on Terminus, a pregnant wife, and I want to get back to her. You can afford to think only of yourself. I can't. Besides, I've come to warn you. By Selden, I'm trying to do that, and you won't listen. You keep talking about other things.
I'm not impressed by your sudden concern for me. What can you warn me against? It seems to me that you are the only thing I need to be warned about. You betray me, and now you follow me in order to betray me again. No one else is doing me any harm.
Campor said earnestly, forget the dramatics, man. Treves, you're a lightning rod. You've been sent out to draw a second Foundation response, if there is such a thing as a second Foundation.
I have an intuitive sense for things other than hyperspatial pursuit, and I'm sure that's what she's planning. If you try to find the second Foundation, they'll become aware of it, and they'll act against you. If they do, they are very likely to tip their hand, and when they do, Mayor Brano will go for them.
A pity your famous intuition wasn't working when Brano was planning my arrest. Campor flushed and muttered, "You know it doesn't always work." "And now it tells you she's planning to attack the Second Foundation. She wouldn't dare."
"I think she would. But that's not the point. The point is that right now she is throwing you out as bait."
"So?"
"So, by all the black holes in space, don't search for the Second Foundation. She won't care if you're killed in the search, but I care. I feel responsible for this, and I care."
"I'm touched," said Dravis coldly. "But as it happens, I have another task on hand at the moment."
"You have?"
"Pellerat and I are on the track of Earth, the planet that some think was the original home of the human race. Aren't we, Genoff?" Pellerat nodded his head.
"Yes, it's a purely scientific matter and a long-standing interest of mine."
Campor looked blank for a moment, then,
"Looking for Earth? But why?"
"To study it," said Pellerat, "as the one world on which human beings developed, presumably from lower forms of life, instead of, as on all others, merely arriving ready-made. It should be a fascinating study in uniqueness." "And," said Trevise, "as a world where, just possibly, I may learn more of the Second Foundation. Just possibly."
Campor said, "But there isn't any Earth. Didn't you know that?"
"No Earth?" Pellerat looked utterly blank, as he always did when he was preparing to be stubborn.
"Are you saying there was no planet on which the human species originated?"
"Oh, no. Of course there was an Earth. There's no question of that. But there isn't any Earth now. No inhabited Earth. It's gone." Pellerat said, unmoved.
"There are tales." "Hold on, Genoff," said Trevise.
"Tell me, Campor, how do you know this?"
"What do you mean, how? It's my heritage. I trace my ancestry from the Sirius sector, if I may repeat that fact without boring you. We know all about Earth out there. It exists in that sector, which means it's not part of the Foundation Federation, so apparently no one on Terminus bothers with it. But that's where Earth is, just the same."
"That is one suggestion, yes," said Pellerat. "There was considerable enthusiasm for that Sirius alternative, as they called it, in the days of the Empire." Campor said vehemently,
"It's not an alternative. It's a fact."
Pellerat said, "What would you say if I told you I know of many different places in the galaxy that are called Earth, or were called Earth, by the people who lived in its stellar neighborhood?"
"But this is the real thing," said Campor. "The Sirius sector is the longest inhabited portion of the galaxy. Everyone knows that."
"The Syrians claim it, certainly," said Pellerat, unmoved. Campor looked frustrated.
"I tell you..."
But Trevise said, "Tell us what happened to Earth. You say it's not inhabited any longer. Why not?"
"Radioactivity. The whole planetary surface is radioactive because of nuclear reactions that went out of control, or nuclear explosions, I'm not sure, and now no life is possible there."
The three stared at each other for a while, and then Campor felt it necessary to repeat. He said,
"I tell you, there's no Earth. There's no use looking for it."
44. Genoff Pellerat's face was, for once, not expressionless. It was not that there was passion in it, or any of the more unstable emotions. It was that his eyes had narrowed, and that a kind of fierce intensity had filled every plane of his face. He said, and his voice lacked any trace of its usual tentative quality,
"How did you say you know all this?" "I told you," said Campor. "It's my heritage."
"Don't be silly, young man. You are a councilman. That means you must be born on one of the Federation worlds. Smyrna, I think you said earlier."
"That's right."
"Well then, what heritage are you talking about? Are you telling me that you possess Syrian genes that fill you with inborn knowledge of the Syrian myths concerning Earth?" Campor looked taken aback.
"No, of course not."
"Then what are you talking about?" Campor paused and seemed to gather his thoughts. He said quietly,
"My family has old books of Syrian history. An external heritage, not an internal one. It's not something we talk about outside, especially if one is intent on political advancement. Trevise seems to think I am, but believe me, I mention it only to good friends."
There was a trace of bitterness in his voice.
"Theoretically, all Foundation citizens are alike, but those from the old worlds of the Federation are more alike than those from the newer ones, and those that trace from worlds outside the Federation are least alike of all. But never mind that. Aside from the books, I once visited the old worlds. Trevise, hey there."
Trevise had wandered off toward one end of the room, looking out a triangular window. It served to let in a view of the sky and to diminish the view of the city. More light and more privacy. Trevise stretched upward to look down. He returned through the empty room. "Interesting window design," he said. "You called me, Councilman?" "Yes. Remember the post-collegiate tour I took?" "After graduation? I remember very well. We were pals. Pals forever. Foundation of trust. Two against the world. You went off on your tour. I joined the Navy, full of patriotism. Somehow, I didn't think I wanted to tour with you. Some instinct told me not to. I wish the instinct had stayed with me." Kampor did not rise to the bait. He said, "I visited Kamporeon. Family tradition said that my ancestors had come from there, at least on my father's side. We were of the ruling family in ancient times, before the Empire absorbed us, and my name is derived from the world, or so the family tradition has it. We had an old poetic name for the star Kamporeon circled, Epsilon Eridani." "What does that mean?" asked Pellerat. Kampor shook his head. "I don't know that it has any meaning, just tradition. They live with a great deal of tradition. It's an old world. They have long, detailed records of Earth's history, but no one talks about it much. They're superstitious about it. Every time they mention the word, they lift up both hands with first and second fingers crossed to ward off misfortune." "Did you tell this to anyone when you came back?" "Of course not. Who would be interested? And I wasn't going to force the tale on anyone. No, thank you. I had a political career to develop, and the last thing I want is to stress my foreign origin." "What about the satellite? Describe Earth's satellite," said Pellerat sharply. Kampor looked astonished. "I don't know anything about that. Does it have one?" "I don't recall reading or hearing about it, but I'm sure if you consult the Kamporeonian records, you can find out." "But you know nothing?" "Not about the satellite, not that I recall." "Hmm. How did Earth come to be radioactive?" Kampor shook his head and said nothing. Pellerat said, "Think, you must have heard something." "It was 7 years ago, Professor. I didn't know then you'd be questioning me about it now. There was some sort of legend. They considered it history." "What was the legend?" "Earth was radioactive, ostracized and mistreated by the Empire, its population dwindling, and it was going to destroy the Empire somehow."
"One dying world was going to destroy the whole Empire," interposed Trevise. Kampor said defensively,
"I said it was a legend. I don't know the details. Del Avardon was involved in the tale, I know."
"Who is he?" asked Trevise.
"A historical character. I looked him up. He was an honest-to-galaxy archaeologist back in the early days of the Empire, and he maintained that Earth was in the Sirius sector."
"I've heard the name," said Pellerat. "He's a folk hero on Kamporeon. Look, if you want to know these things, go to Kamporeon. It's no use hanging around here."
Pellerat said, "Just how did they say Earth planned to destroy the Empire?"
"Don't know."
A certain sullenness was entering Kampor's voice.
"Did the radiation have anything to do with it?"
"Don't know. There were tales of some mind expander developed on Earth, a synapsifier or something."
"Did it create superminds?" said Pellerat in deepest tones of incredulity.
"I don't think so. What I chiefly remember is that it didn't work. People became bright and died young."
Trevise said, "It was probably a morality myth. If you ask for too much, you lose even that which you have." Pellerat turned on Trevise in annoyance.
"What do you know of morality myths?"
Trevise raised his eyebrows. "Your field may not be my field, Genoff, but that doesn't mean I'm totally ignorant."
"What else do you remember about what you call the synapsifier, Councilman Kampor?" said Pellerat.
"Nothing. And I won't submit to any further cross-examination. Look, I followed you on orders from the mayor. I was not ordered to make personal contact with you. I have done so only to warn you that you were followed and tell you that you have been sent out to serve the mayor's purposes, whatever those might be. There was nothing else I should have discussed with you, but you surprised me by suddenly bringing up the matter of Earth. Well, let me repeat. Whatever there has existed there in the past, Del Avardon, the synapsifier, whatever, that has nothing to do with what exists now. I tell you again, Earth is a dead world. I strongly advise you to go to Kamporeon, where you'll find out everything you want to know. Just get away from here."
"And, of course, you will dutifully tell the mayor that we're going to Kamporeon, and you'll follow us to make sure. Or maybe the mayor knows already. I imagine she has carefully instructed and rehearsed you in every word you have spoken to us here, because for her own purposes, it's in Kamporeon that she wants us, right?" Kampor's face paled. He rose to his feet and almost stuttered in his effort to control his voice.
"I've tried to explain. I've tried to be helpful. I shouldn't have tried. You can drop yourself into a black hole, Trevise."
He turned on his heel and walked away briskly without looking back. Pellerat seemed a bit stunned.
"That was rather tactless of you, Golan, old fellow. I could have gotten more out of him."
No, you couldn't, said Trevise gravely. You could not have gotten one thing out of him that he was not ready to let you have. Jenniff, you don't know what he is. Until today, I didn't know what he is.
45. Pellerat hesitated to disturb Trevise. Trevise sat motionless in his chair, deep in thought. Finally, Pellerat said, Are we just sitting here all night, Colin?
Trevise started. No, you're quite right. We'll be better off with people around us. Come.
Pellerat rose. He said, There won't be people around us. Campor said this was some sort of meditation day.
Is that what he said? Was there traffic when we came along the road in our ground car?
Yes, some.
Quite a bit, I thought.
And then, when we entered the city, was it empty?
Not particularly.
Still, you've got to admit that this place has been empty.
Yes, it has. I noticed that particularly. But come, Jenoff, I'm hungry. There's got to be some place to eat, and we can afford to find something good. At any rate, we can find a place in which we can try some interesting Seychellian novelty, or if we lose our nerve, good standard galactic fare. Come, once we're safely surrounded, I'll tell you what I think really happened here.
46. Trevise leaned back with a pleasant feeling of renewal. The restaurant was not expensive by Terminus standards, but it was certainly novel. It was heated in part by an open fire over which food was prepared. Meat tended to be served in bite-sized portions in a variety of pungent sauces, which were picked up by fingers that were protected from grease and heat by smooth green leaves that were cold, damp, and had a vaguely minty taste. It was one leaf to each meat bit, and the whole was taken into the mouth. The waiter had carefully explained how it had to be done. Apparently accustomed to off-planet guests, he had smiled paternally as Trevise and Pellerat gingerly scooped at the steaming bits of meat, and was clearly delighted at the foreigner's relief at finding that the leaves kept the fingers cool and cooled the meat, too, as one chewed. Trevise said, Delicious, and eventually ordered a second helping. So did Pellerat. They sat over a spongy, vaguely sweet dessert and a cup of coffee that had a caramelized flavor, at which they shook dubious heads. They added syrup, at which the waiter shook his head.
Pellerat said, Well, what happened back there at the tourist center?
You mean with Campor?
Was there anything else there we might discuss?
Trevise looked about. They were in a deep alcove and had a certain limited privacy, but the restaurant was crowded, and the natural hum of noise was a perfect cover. He said in a low voice, Isn't it strange that he followed us to Seychelles?
He said he had this intuitive ability.
Yes, he was all-collegiate champion at hypertracking. I never questioned that till today. I quite see that you might be able to judge where someone was going to jump by how he prepared for it if you had a certain developed skill at it, certain reflexes. But I don't see how a tracker can judge a jump series. You prepare only for the first one. The computer does all the others. The tracker can judge that first one. But by what magic can he guess what's in the computer's vitals?
But he did it, Golan.
He certainly did, said Trevise. And the only possible way I can imagine him doing so is by knowing in advance where we were going to go. By knowing, not judging.
Pellerat considered that.
Quite impossible, my boy. How could he know? We didn't decide on our destination till after we were on board the Far Star.
I know that.
And what about this day of meditation?